We call the meeting to order, and the first order of business is Judge Johnson from the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals for their budget overview. Welcome to the committee, Your Honor, and come on down and tell us how you're going to expedite all those cases that my constituents have. How you're going to be holding courts up in range this year instead of Duluth. I didn't look. Was that in the budget?
That was not in the budget, Mr. President.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Again, my name is Tom Johnson. I'm the Chief Judge of the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. And with me is my Administrative Assistant, Elaine Hikas.
Welcome.
I'm going to be very brief. I think we are new to this committee, so I'm going to give you a little overview of what we do and then talk for a few minutes about our budget. And if any of the committee members have any questions as we go along, please let me know. The division of labor is that I handle the easy questions and Elaine gets the hard questions. So be kind to her. The Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals is part of the dispute resolution process for workers' compensation. We function like a court, although we are part of the executive branch of government, not the judicial branch, which is why we're here for our budget approval. The process in workers' compensation is that when an employee files a claim, the case gets tried at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And if either party is unhappy with the result, then they appeal to us, who function as an intermediate appellate court. And after our decision, if a party is still unhappy, they appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. There are five judges on our court, and we function in panels of three. We work from a written record of the transcript of the testimony and the exhibits, and then we write a written decision, which has to be approved by all three judges. Essentially, that's how our court functions. I say very much like the intermediate appellate court. In terms of our budget, any committee members who are not familiar with, we are funded by the Special Compensation Fund. We are not a general fund agency. The Special Compensation Fund is itself funded by insurers, workers' compensation insurers, and self-insured employers who pay benefits to workers. Each year they are assessed a certain amount of certain percentage of the benefits paid, and that makes up the fund. I believe for fiscal year 2007, the special fund was about $98 million. Most of that money is used to pay what are called supplementary benefits or second fund injury benefits. Our budget is also paid out of that, and it's less than 2% of the fund. And the governor's recommendation for our budget is essentially a 3.25% increase for each of the two years of the budgetary cycle. Our court pays about 77% of our budget in salaries. So the reason we are looking for the increase, the reason the governor recommended this small increase to you is to cover step increases for government employees, some increases in insurance costs, which, as you know, are ongoing every year, health insurance, and some increases for the retirement benefits that are scheduled for the upcoming fiscal year. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions for Judge Johnson? I have one. I just wanted to know, Your Honor, if the has the FTE number dropped in recent years at the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals?
Mr. Chairman, it has not dropped in recent. In the last 3 or 4 years, it has not dropped. Prior to that, we trimmed our personnel quite a bit.
And let's say, Elaine, maybe do you want to answer that question? His Honor said we refer the tough questions to you. Do you remember what the FTE equivalent was?
We were up to 20 employees. Now I think we're down to 14.5 or something.
Yeah. And so, Your Honor, has that created any type of a backlog? Because I've had some complaints, and as a matter of fact, I think 2 years ago on the House floor, I tried to increase
your numbers again, and but I didn't win. But I'll bet you this year I might be able to do that. And I'm just wondering, because I had complaints about, you know, the judges that travel out, and I think you have hearings in Duluth and probably in places in all corners of the state. Has there been a backlog?
Mr. Chairman, there's not a backlog at our level. I think what you were referring to is perhaps the judges that travel are the trial judges at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Okay.
If there have been any complaints about our court, I would ask you to please direct them to me, and I will promptly respond to them. We are statutorily mandated to issue a written decision within 90 days of the date that after which we have oral argument, or with no oral argument, the date that the case is assigned to the panel. And I checked before I came, our average is 50 days from that date. So we are well within our statutory mandate.
So it is the administrative law judges that hear the case initially then that I'm hearing about from...
I don't know about whom you're hearing, sir.
About constituents, from constituents that their case has been canceled or moved back because there weren't enough judges. So it's probably in that area then. And have you heard any complaints in that area from attorneys or injured workers?
I have not, sir.
Okay, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the complaints I get are the type of legal help the injured worker gets compared to one that works for a big company, and how that big company can make that case linger on and on and on until there's a personal crisis in their family. And I hear this complaint from people in my district all the time. So where he has 90 days, is that correct?
That's correct.
He has 90 days to rule on it. The case can go on for years.
Yes.
And that's the problem we'll have. Is that correct, Judge?
I don't know what the time limits, what the time are at the Office of Administrative Hearings. I can only speak about our agencies. And again, our cases are issued within 50 days of the date of assignment.
Representative Gunther, I know I have, you know, this was a big issue that it really hasn't been around the legislature since the, you know, 95 law change. But prior to that, workers' compensation was always a big issue at the Capitol. And every year we'd have bills, and either former governors like Perpich would veto them and save everybody, or we'd have to, you know, have override attempts, or there were, then the 92 bill, there were some minor changes where it was kind of evenly distributed, the pain, but the 95 bill was a little different, and I had argued during that bill, Your Honor, that there were going to be people that were going to actually be financially and, you know, medically hurt by that bill, and I think it's, at least I've known several of my own constituents who have been hurt by those law changes, and I know there are a number of bills that are floating around here that were just introduced, or they were getting signatures today to address some of those issues. But I don't think anybody should lose their, you know, what little assets they've built up, or end up after they reach MMI in a situation where their whole life is jeopardized. And that kind of has been happening. And we got that feedback again today. Mr. Galvin, am I causing that?
Mr. Chairman,
do we have some maybe divine intervention here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we were notified this morning that this is a recurring problem in this room and several other rooms. They've asked everyone in the room to turn off both cell phones and Blackberries, because that apparently is what's causing it, is that any time a message comes into your cell phone or Blackberry, it interferes with the audio system.
Well, okay.
Mr. Chairman, I agree that things were very, very comfortable for an injured worker pre-95, but at the same time, relative to our neighboring states, they're still pretty comfortable here in Minnesota. Everything didn't crash and burn. The true endangered species in our area is an injured worker in South Dakota. They are truly in danger. However, you look at what we pay and the benefits that we get here in Minnesota, it's substantially above in Wisconsin, which both parties sign off on often in Wisconsin. So I know one of my biggest concerns pertaining to work comp is the treatment they get in law and how they can virtually starve a person to death as an injured worker because they have 45 attorneys that make these things last forever. And the injured worker is kind of an orphan and doesn't have what representation they should have.
Well, I don't know any injured worker who's comfortable, maybe compared to South Dakota, but then again, I'd say the grocers in Minnesota are more comfortable than the ones in South Dakota. And the retired grocers.
I don't know. You know, all the business costs in South Dakota are much less. The grocers are probably more comfortable in South Dakota.
Okay, any other questions for our witnesses? Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next we have House File 34. Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, welcome to the committee. And I would move that House File 34 be recommended pass and re-referred to Public Safety Policy Committee. Okay. Representative Kahn, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased to be here. Can I ask just a second as to what your time specifications are?
I would like, I think we have, eight witnesses, so I'm going to ask them to limit their testimony to 5 minutes, if we could do that. Representative Kahn, but of course you will need a little more time to present your bill, and so go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. House File 34 is a bill that makes it absolutely clear that embryonic stem cell research is consistent with Minnesota law. It also provides for informed consent of patients undergoing infertility treatment, allowing the patients to decide on the use of their embryos. Passage of this bill will allow Minnesota to join other states, California, Massachusetts, Illinois, Maryland, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Missouri, which just did it this year by an initiative which was probably responsible for the determination of their Senate election, which was probably responsible for the determination of the control of the Senate. So in will help us join these states to being a leading bioscience research center. The importance of public funding is that public funding means that the research will be done in public view and that the results will be available to the public. The bill also sends a message to the federal government, although other people are sending this message. The House is part of the 100-hour initiative, passed by a measure of 258 to 174, I believe, House File 3, authorizing the use of federal funds to stem cell research. That's 20 votes up from the last time this bill was passed. Then it was passed by the House and the Senate, where I think the margin was 258 positive is 238 to 174. So the margins are increasing in two consecutive votes over 2 years that the U.S. House has taken. The margin on a bipartisan basis are increasing in favor of embryonic stem cell research. And the major point for Minnesota is we don't want to outsource superior science. This research will be done somewhere. This research can be opposed by folks on moral grounds, but should not be opposed by the force of law. An argument that says this process destroys life is wrong. Countless fertilized eggs are destroyed through in vitro fertilization techniques. And actually, this is something which I've tried to address by an amendment in the House. For people who are interested in the moral, in the preservation of the embryo, there's a terrific package here, which is a report called Reproduction and Responsibility, the Regulation of New Biotechnologies, a report of the President's Council on Bioethics. And there is a lot of material in this for bills that would look at the protection, at the potential of embryos. I once had an amendment on the House floor, that which I can pass out later if people want to see it, which actually would have put some of the conclusions of the President's report into state law, just to the point of having the Department of Health study them and look at drafting this kind of legislation to protect to look at the process of in vitro fertilization. The bill was resoundingly defeated, I can say, on a bipartisan basis. So there were 28 yeas and 97 nays. But I do have the copy of that proposed amendment, and I do have the and I also have the report, and I've also have in my office some copies of the executive summary if you don't quite want to deal with the full 300 pages. But there are things that we could be doing, to which I would strongly support, although the limits to how many bills I'm willing to introduce this year, that would look at the process of the use of embryos. So what's happening, is what we're saying, though, is that people with Parkinson's disease, diabetes, ALS, multiple sclerosis, should not be forced to suffer or die because of someone else's religious convictions. Cells that would have died are used to continue life. What could be more pro-life than that? Mr. Chairman, I don't know how you want to proceed. If you want me to take some questions now, I do have a couple of witnesses I'd like to present. I'd like to have...
Representative Pine, if there's any witnesses, any questions right now from the committee, I'd entertain them. Otherwise, you can move on to your witnesses.
Mr. Chair, is it just a procedural question? Is this going to be passed on to another committee after this thing?
Yes, the motion, Representative McFarland, was to pass it on to Civil and Criminal Justice.
Thank you.
So it will be getting another hearing there. There are some penalties, as you notice on the back page, and the Representative Mullery wanted to see the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, the first person I'd actually like to have speak, but she was really shortchanged in the last committee, is Jackie Christensen. I believe is the Vice President, Vice Chair. She'll tell you who she is.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jackie Hunt Christensen. And although I am the Vice President of the Parkinson's Association of Minnesota and the State Coordinator for the Parkinson's Action Network, today I'm speaking just as a person with Parkinson's. I'm here today to urge you to pass House File 34. Representative Kahn and the other sponsors of the bill understand that it is not enough to support only research on stem cells from cord blood or other non-controversial sources. Those cells may yield treatments and even cures for many blood diseases and other health problems, and that's wonderful. But they have not shown promise for chronic illnesses such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, juvenile diabetes, that affect thousands of Minnesotans. Yet researchers have high hopes for treatments and cures from embryonic stem cell research. I've had Parkinson's for about 10 years. I've gone from being a physically active mother of a 5-year-old and a young baby to having to leave my job 3 years ago because I had difficulty getting around my office. I couldn't talk on the phone or type because of severe writhing movements called dyskinesia that are caused by the medication. For those of you who've seen Michael J. Fox lately, he's not faking. He is taking his medication. Those movements are very uncomfortable and painful, and he was about as calm as Buddha compared to how I was. My disease had progressed to a point where I felt compelled to do something that I thought I would never, that I swore I would never ever do, and that was undergo deep brain stimulation surgery. 1 year ago, I underwent 2 very expensive and painful operations one to implant electrodes deep in my brain while I was awake, and the other to implant two pacemaker batteries in my chest. While this operation has been successful for me, and I'm thrilled about that, I know that it doesn't help everyone, though as much as it has helped me, not as everyone is a candidate. It's very expensive, and it's not a cure. I know that many of us in the Parkinson's community believe that embryonic stem cell research deserves government funding and oversight because it may lead to a better understanding of the disease and treatments, if not a cure. Yes, there is some private funding available for embryonic stem cell research, but scientists must keep private research completely separate from any projects that receive government funds, usually by having two of everything. In other words, we could fund almost twice as much research if there weren't for the current use of government monies being banned for expanded embryonic stem cell lines. This is a waste of time, talent, and money. Dr. Story Landis, the director of the National Institutes of Neurological Diseases and Stroke, and the interim chair of the NIH's Stem Cell Task Force, testified last month before the Senate a month ago. In her oral remarks, she said, quote, "We are missing out on possible breakthroughs. The ability to work on newly derived stem cell colonies precluded from federal funding under the Bush plan would be incredibly important." Landis also declared that, quote, "Science works best when scientists can pursue all avenues of research. If the cure for Parkinson's disease or juvenile diabetes lay behind one of four doors, wouldn't you want to open all four doors at once instead of one door?" To those who say no cures have come from embryonic stem cell research, 72 cures and treatments have come from adult stem cells, I say congratulations to the people who've gotten help. But let's explore embryonic stem cells so that those of us who can't be helped by adult cells have a chance too. The basic research that led to the development of the use of bone marrow in adult stem cells began in the 1930s. The first actual non-twin bone marrow transplant took place here in Minnesota in 1968, at least 30 years after the research began. Embryonic stem cells were discovered in 1989. Opponents of embryonic stem cell research are trying to hold this emerging science to a difficult burden of proof, and that is unfair. I would like to ask all the members of the committee, how many of you support in vitro fertilization? How many of you know someone personally who has gotten pregnant through IVF? In the U.S., the IVF process involves taking many eggs from the female donor because it's safer that way. Many embryos are created and inevitably more than are needed. IVF began in 1978, so just imagine how many excess embryos have been discarded. All that this legislation would do is allow some of those, the ones specifically designated for research by donors, to potentially extend the life of someone like me. Most people agree with me. Prior to last November's elections, we learned that nearly three-quarters of American voters surveyed were in favor of embryonic stem cell research. Well-known pro-life Republicans such as Senator Orrin Hatch and Arlen Specter support it. The Central Conference of American Rabbis and the United Methodist Church support it. This is not a liberal fringe issue. It is one that strikes at the heart of tens of thousands of Minnesota families. Please vote for hope. Please pass House File 34. Thank you.
Questions of Ms. Christensen? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Fairpo.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Professor?
Chair Riccavina and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come here to talk to you today. My name is Mary Furpo. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota in the Division of Endocrinology and the Stem Cell Institute. My background and my training came at the Cornell University Medical College and the Sloan Kettering Institute in the 1980s when stem cell research was first being talked about in those terms. And I was trained in a lab that did bone marrow transplantation mostly for leukemia. And this is where stem cell research was really born. But unfortunately, even in diseases where stem cells are available for therapies, most people who need the therapy, bone marrow transplant, don't have access to donor embryos, so a donor of stem cells. So I started to look into other sources of stem cells and ways of studying the diseases so that we could actually learn more about how the disease occurs and come up with ways, maybe non-transplantation research, that would allow us to treat diseases or understand diseases in new ways, and came to embryonic stem cells in the mouse just as the field was beginning, and actually did manage to come up with a bone marrow type stem cell from mouse embryonic stem cells that we can use to cure diseases in mice. More recently, human embryonic stem cells were made available, and this was at the time I was at the University of California, San Francisco, trying to create human embryonic stem cells for the purpose of bone marrow transplantation. And even though the adult stem cells can be used for that therapy to provide for people who had no access to a matched donor. Since that time, I derived two of the embryonic stem cell lines that are included on the President's Registry and eligible for federal funding, and many, many more lines that I derived after that time that are actually made under conditions that are more suitable for therapeutic applications, in that they were not grown in the presence of mouse cells or in the presence of cow serum. But these cell lines are not eligible for federal funding. So since that time, in the late 1990s, I've had two separate labs, first at the University of California and now at the University of Minnesota. And in California, my lab was actually in a strip mall in a rented facility where I had to actually negotiate rent and negotiate for leaks in the ceiling and things like that. We were able to make these cell lines under those conditions. But I find myself spending a good deal of my time trying to raise money, and somebody pointed out to me this morning, 15% of my time talking to people about embryonic stem cell research and trying to raise money from small foundations and private donors to support this research. The type of research that I do now, I was asked to join the diabetes research community because there is no stem cell therapy for diabetes, and this is a more and more prevalent disease. In fact, we don't know of an adult stem cell in the pancreas that can give rise to insulin-producing cells. So I was asked to apply my expertise in bone marrow transplant and embryonic stem cell research to try and find novel ways of curing this disease, and was asked to come to the University of Minnesota because of this transition in my research focus. The University of Minnesota has asked me to come here from the University of California, San Francisco, where I began the embryonic stem cell program, because they have a history of adult stem cell research and wanted someone who could work in parallel so that we could learn from each other's research and move the field forward even more quickly. That's not really the reason I came here. The reason I came here was because I wanted to work in a center where there were opportunities to work with other stem cell researchers in the same place. The University of Minnesota has the world's first stem cell institute. It is still the most prominent stem cell institute in the United States, and has primarily in the past focused on adult stem cells and has done quite well. But I found that stem cell institutes typically are not centers where you can work together physically in the same building. This has given me an opportunity to work with people who are working on embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells, both in other areas, in Parkinson's disease, in bone marrow transplantation, but also in diabetes. The other reason that I came to the University of Minnesota was because of their long history of transplantation therapy for diabetes, which gives us a context to move towards if we are to find a source of cells that we can use for transplantation for diabetes. And as Jackie said, the first successful bone marrow transplant was done here at the University of Minnesota in 1968. This is a center of transplantation research, the cutting edge of transplantation research, and the scientists here were looking for other sources of cells that they could use for therapies that were not accessible by other transplantation means. Now, the embryos that I use for my research, and we do work on embryonic stem cells at the University of Minnesota, and we do derive embryonic stem cell lines at the University of Minnesota in my lab, the embryos actually come from two places. They always come from families who have already decided to discard the embryos. In most cases, the embryos are discarded because they are considered by the embryologist in the clinic to be too poor quality to lead to a pregnancy. Most of these lines that I've derived in my lab have come from these embryos. In addition, and more recently, we also receive embryos from couples, from families who have finished their reproductive therapies and have excess embryos that they don't need. And generally, these people either contact me or contact me through their clinic and offer their embryos to our lab. We don't actually go out and ask for these. But I wanted to tell you that this work is going on at the University of Minnesota, and maybe a fact that you don't know, that the scientists in the stem cell field, adult and embryonic stem cell field, by and large, do not disagree on the fact that we should be doing research in all areas of stem cells at the same time. This is an argument that is actually not based on science, but based on other issues that are important and should be considered. But if there's no real controversy in the scientific community, then with that, maybe we can take questions.
Questions of Ms. Fairfield? Okay, thank you both very much for your testimony then. I'm sure you're going to stick around. Representative Kahn, we have one more person that wants to testify, I believe, in support of this. Mr. Griffin, would you come up, please, and identify yourself?
Yeah, other persons have said a few words in the past with Linda Sandvig from the Medical Association.
And I believe Mr. Griffin is also.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I'm here representing Life Science Alley today. Mr. Chairman, members, Life Science Alley is an organization of over 500 life science member organizations who represent industries and organizations from the food to the environment side of our world, from animal health to human health, and represents a market-focused system based on improving and sustaining people's health and well-being. Our legislative agenda focuses on several issue areas, including the need to support public research, the need for a highly educated workforce to continue our businesses, and business and job development. Our position on stem cell research, we think, is a simple one. Cutting-edge research is being conducted at the University of Minnesota on stem cell technology, which is the basic building block for a new generation of regenerative medicine. Bills have been introduced in the legislature in the past which would have cut off funding or would have provided funding or established a state policy on stem cell research. You've heard the university testify in the past that restricting funding or the legality of research would be premature and harmful to both the scientific process and to the patients who would benefit from the treatments developed from that research. A public university provides oversight, public oversight, and review of all research. Research has driven innovation in the biosciences in Minnesota and has been the result of that Minnesota jobs. Research at the university has been critical to our industry, and Life Science Alley continues to support the university's research in stem cells. Mr. Chairman, members, I just remind you that we are not an island in this world. We are in competition for the jobs and for the future jobs that will result from the research that's being done. In California, voters in 2004, as you know, passed Proposition 71, creating a $3 billion pool of funds to be distributed in embryonic stem cell research. Connecticut plans to award $100 million over 10 years for embryonic stem cell research. Illinois has budgeted $10 million in the past year. New Jersey authorized $270 million in funding to build a stem cell research center. And New York Governor Eliot Spitzer is proposing a $2 billion 10-year research program. Some states are providing funds for sciences, but their resources are limited. Without federal funding, embryonic stem cell research advocates say the U.S. will fall behind in this field. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as we said, we believe that public oversight is a good thing, and this will provide you with public oversight. If there are questions that you have, we would be happy to answer them. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Any questions of Mr. Griffin? Okay, with that, Representative Kahn, I think we'll bring up the folks that have concerns with your legislation, starting with Bishop Pace. Bishop, welcome to the committee. And you can just identify yourself for the tape, Bishop, and then go right into your testimony. Welcome. It's nice to see you.
Okay, thank you. And good afternoon, Chairman Rakovina and members of the committee. My name is Bishop Richard Pates, and I am the Auxiliary Bishop of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And I am speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, representing my fellow Catholic bishops of the six dioceses and the 1.25 million Catholics of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I am here to speak in opposition to House File 34 because of its explicit allowance of embryonic stem cell research and its language that permits the University of Minnesota to use state funding to conduct such research. Catholic moral teaching and the principles upon which our teaching is founded, its Aristotelian roots and Judeo-Christian tradition instructs us that every human life from the moment of conception until natural death has intrinsic dignity and deserves our respect and protection. The stage of development or circumstances of the conception of any human does not diminish intrinsic dignity. We may not choose to value some humans more than others because we think that something about their nature or development differentiates them from any of us or from what is human. The evident applicability of these principles is universal, and thus our advocacy is not of religious derivation, but is based on the truth of what constitutes the human person. Embryos created for fertility treatment should not be exempt from the legal or ethical standards that would be applied to any other unborn embryo. An unborn child in the womb is protected by legal and ethical standards from being destroyed for research purposes. The so-called excess embryos in any situation should not become fodder for lethal experimentation simply because they may die soon, any more than a prisoner condemned to death or a terminally ill patient should. Our principles surrounding the inherent dignity of human life and our conviction that deliberately destroying human life for research purposes, regardless of a human's development, is morally wrong, are not only held by religious adherents, but by a wide spectrum of Minnesotans. Since you and I are the same persons at every stage of development, any direct intervention to end life at any point means a particular person no longer exists. We should not be forced by our state government to pay for the direct killing of innocent human persons with our tax dollars. To ask us to do so is to ask us to violate our core principles, the very foundation of our beings. My fellow bishops and I would therefore urge the bill's author to consider amending the bill to exclude the use of embryonic stem cells. In addition to the grave moral issues surrounding the use of embryonic stem cells, it is our understanding that use of stem cells from adults, amniotic fluid, and umbilical cord blood for research continues to hold great promise and can accomplish the admirable goals of addressing illness, physical deterioration, and aging. In other words, we can have our cake and eat it too, if we accept reasonable limitations and the responsibility entrusted to us to protect life at all stages. We urge you, the members of our state legislature, to bear in mind that any decisions regarding biotechnology and human experimentation must be based upon our respect for the dignity of human life from its very beginning. If we allow and even encourage through state funding the direct destruction of some humans for the potential benefit of others, then we are jeopardizing the values that make up the fabric of our society and running the risk of progressively relativizing human life. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Bishop Pates. Are there any questions, for Bishop? Thanks. Stick around. We'll maybe have some questions later.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Julie Nickum from the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life. Welcome to the committee. And just identify yourself and start off.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Nickum, and I'm here today to represent MCCL. MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, is an organization that started in 1968 and holds 77,000 members across the state of Minnesota, consisting of 241 chapters. Since the beginning of MCCL in 1968, its foundational mission has been to defend and protect innocent life, and in that it does include embryos. So we are here today to oppose House File 34 and its wide open science for the following reasons. We oppose any form of tax dollars for embryonic stem cell research, as we believe the intentional and utilitarian destruction of human life is immoral and barbaric in its nature. No civil society can ultimately survive when using one human being as a commodity for another human being's gain. We oppose any form of human cloning or science referred to as somatic cell nuclear transfer. At present, SCNT requires human eggs, and the promise of life they hold is simply for the destruction and experimentation of them. We oppose egg harvesting as a commodity for the purposes of producing embryos to conduct this research. This can, and it does, lead to exploitation of women and their children. We are not alone in this concern. Just this week in the Pioneer Press, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the U of M Center of Bioethics, discussed the ramifications associated with stem cell science in an article titled, More Women Giving Up Their Eggs for Pay, and you do have a copy of that that we handed out of the full article. Dr. Kahn sees the problem growing as states such as California move closer to funding major stem cell research, requiring more eggs. This does require human eggs to continue in this research. He quotes, we worry that we offer people so much money that they are blind to the risk and their motivation is strictly that. So I'm not comfortable saying we should start that with human eggs. It does feel a little more like the Wild West than it ought to. We have heard from many that the life agenda is not relevant, that it is old news, and that it is unresolvable. But we are here today to say that is simply not true. While embryonic stem cell research has so-called potential, we believe it has dangers that have not been thoroughly and responsibly discussed and addressed. Embryonic stem cell research ultimately creates a market which demands the creation and the destruction of a human being as a commodity. We do not believe this is ethical, moral, or responsible science. For these reasons, Minnesota Concerned Citizens for Life opposes House File 34. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Any questions for Ms. Nickum? Thank you. And did the mics go off? I thought you... Maybe my hearing's going on me. I thought it got a little softer there towards the end. Next testimony is from Dr. Stephen Kelvin, Representative Detmers. Do you want to introduce
him? Yeah, I'd like to introduce Dr. Stephen Kelvin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to testify and appreciate the invitation of Representative Detmer. My name is Steve Kelvin. I have serious concerns about the bill known as House File 34. I'm a physician, board certified in obstetrics and gynecology with a subspecialization in maternal fetal medicine, and I'm in my 18th year of medical practice caring for high-risk pregnancies here in Minnesota. I work for a line of hospitals and clinics. I'm also an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, where I am involved in research and teaching on a volunteer basis. For the last 10 years, I've also been the co-chair of the program in Human Rights and Medicine, now known as Human Rights and Health in the School of Public Health. My testimony today is my own and is independent of any of my affiliations. My medical research over the last 5 years has focused on the biomechanics of human fetal membranes and why they rupture prematurely. A colleague and I, who has since left to take over a program at Cambridge University in England, have published 4 studies and presented our work at an international scientific meeting in Munich last summer. In addition, for the last 3 years, I have been collaborating with a colleague at the University of Minnesota Stem Cell Institute. This collaboration involves the collection of unused umbilical cord blood from babies born prematurely and at term, and as well, recently, because of the interest in the amnion, we're trying to grow some of the stem cells on the amnion from the placenta from which the baby came. I am clearly in support of advancing scientific work on the potential of human stem cells to treat diseases. What I and many others, however, oppose is crossing into the ethically dangerous area that involves the use and destruction of human embryos and fetuses for medical purposes. House File 34 clearly goes across the line for the following reasons. This bill purports to be limited and to address the ethical concerns, but it actually permits the use of human embryos from well beyond those at the stage of frozen embryos from infertility clinics. In humans, the embryo is defined as the product of conception from implantation in the uterus through the eighth week of development. An embryo is called a fetus at a more advanced stage of development up until birth. And so in humans, this is from the eighth week on. But this bill speaks almost interchangeably, embryos, fetal tissue. It speaks of using human embryonic germ cells. And these germ cells generally would be eggs, and they could be obtained only by dissecting them out of fetuses. Either from ignorance or subterfuge, this bill therefore permits and encourages the use of fetal parts for research. In addition, it has been claimed that somatic cell nuclear transfer is not human cloning. In fact, it is the first step in all cloning. Cloning to birth may not be the purpose of this bill, and I doubt that it is, but it has insufficient protections from that. We all wish to see cures for diseases and to see Minnesota take the lead in the use of human stem cells in this effort. This bill, however, is an ethical and financial Trojan horse. It promises safeguards that it cannot deliver, and it crosses ethical boundaries to utilize early forms of human life as commodities. And I therefore recommend that the committee vote against it in its present form. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify and we take any questions.
Any questions for Dr. Calvin? Left them fine.
Thank you. In what form would you accept this?
Doctor? Probably in significant limitation, avoiding the use of any human embryos in a destructive fashion. The thing that most concerned me is my reading of it. I just tried to, and it may be that it was an oversight, but the discussion of using germ cells from fetuses, that really gets into an area that's very concerning. I think it would be concerning to most Minnesotans that would be potentially, because of the concerns about women having to have eggs harvested for much of this, one of the alternatives would be, well, why don't we harvest eggs out of unwanted fetal tissue? And that would most likely be after elective abortion. And I think that just sets a precedent that's a really bad one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, do you know of any successful outcomes using embryonic stem cell research?
I have to say that I'm not an expert in stem cell research at all, although I have a very great interest in it. Dr. Firpo could probably speak to that. And so I have to say I don't know.
Representative Gottfried, would you care to ask Dr. Fairpaw that?
I would very much like to.
Dr. Fairpaw?
So far, we've only cured mice, but there's no restrictions on mouse embryonic stem cell research. There's been no treatment so far that's gone to clinical trials with human embryonic stem cells, although the FDA is considering several such clinical trials. For spinal cord injury and for remyelination in diseases like muscular dystrophy. Multiple sclerosis.
Representative Martin.
Chair Rukavina, members. Dr. Purple, could you address the fact how much time would a researcher continue to work on embryonic stem cells if all of the research that you did had failed?
Well, the research we are doing is not failing. And there's more than one reason to use these cells. One is to create cells for transplantation. This is the most straightforward way. Probably not the most productive way. What we can learn from these cells, though, is using them as a model of human development and understand how disease processes actually occur, intervene with the disease processes without actually transplanting ES-derived cells. These will happen. These studies have been happening. We've already learned about differences between the way mouse insulin-producing cells and human insulin-producing cells develop. And those will be put into practice. So it's too late to fail. We've already succeeded.
And Chair Rukavina, if I could continue. One of the points that's been seems to keep coming up is that because there's no proof that this happens, we shouldn't move forward. And in fact, you're saying there is proof. And I guess the point I was trying to make is if, in fact, as a researcher, you and other people at any institution found that it was not valuable, you would stop.
Yes, we wouldn't be able to get any funding if it wasn't working.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
I think you can answer this particular question, and I don't remember where I read it, but all the embryonic stem cells that are we can work on, unless they're privately funded, are mouse, have been mixed with mouse DNA, so they can't really be used in humans?
Okay, well, I just clarified. We grow these cells. The way we propagate them, we grow them on top of other cells that have been inactivated. The initial cells, lines that we derived that are actually eligible for federal funding were all grown in contact with mouse cells. This works very well, by the way. But for clinical uses, it would be better if we didn't co-culture our cells in the presence of other species so that we could potentially transmit diseases that are not transmittable normally. So the new cell lines that have all been derived on human cells with no other other species DNA or cells are not eligible for federal funding. This is true.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Now, in that same article, are these embryonic stem cells that are eligible, what ethnic groups did they come from? There was a comment, and again, I haven't read this for several weeks at least. My understanding was that it all came from white Caucasian suburban people.
There's no way to actually know that.
No offense to suburban people.
These embryos were all donated anonymously. We don't actually directly receive embryos from the donors. We only do it anonymously through the clinic. This is meant to protect the privacy of the donors. So we don't actually collect data on that, and I don't know of anyone who has. But they were all donated through people who could afford IVF treatment.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you both very much. Oh, excuse me. Where is my Representative Searson? Excuse me. Ms. Fairpoke? And maybe, Doctor, you might want to come back to it.
Okay, Ms. Fairpoke, you were saying that you are using embryonic cells for the research in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
These live cells?
Yeah.
Well, how do you get around statute on it? Can you break me in?
Which statute are you talking about?
144.421.
Well, I'm not an expert in Minnesota law, but my understanding is that that this does not violate statute, and you may maybe want to talk to someone who's an expert on that.
But
this is the policy of the University of Minnesota.
But we'll let counsel answer that. She's not an attorney.
Mr. Chairman and members, the law that Representative Severson is referring to, I'm trying to find it here, There are two parts to the law. It's a very old law in Minnesota. It was first enacted in 1973, and it provides a penalty for anyone who uses or permits the use of a living human conceptus. The first part of the bill defines all of the terms that are used, and living is defined to have certain characteristics. We're getting there. I'm sorry. And living is defined for the purpose of this section to mean the presence or evidence of life, such as movement, heart, or respiratory activity, the presence of I'm sorry, I can't pronounce these words, but it's some type of encephalographic graphic activity. electroencephalographic activity. And that's been the law in Minnesota since, as I said, 1973.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The embryos we use for this research do not have those characteristics.
Mr. Senator, Representative Stevenson.
Ms. Purple, I asked you if it was a living cell. You said yes.
The cells are alive.
Okay. And I think that's the premise of the statute. It basically says a living.
I disagree with that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
Example.
You just said it was live. I guess the next question I would have then, if it isn't a live cell, why would you proceed with the experiment?
Dr. Mr. Chair, I think there's a misunderstanding here. There's a difference between a live cell and a live human. You could actually donate your bone marrow and we could propagate your live cells and use them for research or for therapeutic applications, but that would not constitute doing research on a human being or you.
Representative Hartman, do you want to weigh in on this?
I don't want to interrupt the follow-up.
I guess just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I think on this is when we're talking about an embryonic cell, the thing that draws us to the research on the embryonic cell is that it actually multiplies. One of the constraints on this is that there are there's movement within the cell. And the argument would be, well, it's not moving. Well, it may not be moving at this very second, but it's about to multiply. And that's why I think that in this particular case, the experiments that Ms. Purple are doing are a gross misdemeanor. And that aside, let me just give a little bit of background on the 1973 bill that was enacted after the...
Mr. Chair, then I would like to ask my question because this is far beyond a follow-up. Mr. Chair, it seems to me that this line of questioning is sort of beyond the scope of what would be the type of questioning we would want to have of witnesses pertaining to bills. The witness is here testifying as to whether or not she supports House File 34. She's testifying about her research at the University of Minnesota. It seems to me that the proper venue to complain about an alleged violation of law is not in committee at the House of Representatives. And I'm concerned a little bit about the direction we're going with the line of questioning to the witness.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman, if things get out of line here, I know what to do. So I thought Dr. Kerper was handling the questions quite well, and that Representative Stevenson was being as civil as he always is, and possibly can be. Okay, go ahead.
You're very gracious, Mr. Chair. And just a little bit of, you know, as I was digging into this, figuring out why in 1973, when we didn't even have, stem cell research taking place, it was because that was Roe v. Wade. And they did not want fetuses that had been aborted to be used for this type of purpose. And I guess this comes to the slippery slope that we have this bill before us today, which now goes to the point of, are we going to use state funding when it becomes morally an issue for constituents of this state to actually fund what we believe is morally wrong? There's a great excerpt on the House floor, or up on the floor in Capitol, that says that which is morally wrong cannot be ethically right. And so I don't mean to pick on Ms. Purple right now. In fact, I think I'd rather pick on Representative Todd at this point. But I
want to watch that. Representative Todd, come on up. You want to get involved in this debate, Representative Todd? Because I think you can handle yourself.
Well,
absolutely.
But I don't.
Well,
I don't know. I would like to get through the rest of the witnesses first before we get into this debate, which I'm sure we're going to have. So, Representative Haas, do you have a question to these?
No, it's been asked and answered.
Okay, Representative Nornes, to these, the doctor.
Well, I guess my question that could be answered by any of the witnesses, I guess. Several of them are associated with the University of Minnesota. My question, I guess, is what is the official position that the university has on this bill? Does anyone know?
I know the university does not take an official position. There's clearly, you know, support for embryonic stem cell research. Part of the reason that I've gotten involved in this is that I've been willing to articulate a different position. And in some ways, maybe it's for political cover or other reasons, but I've been invited on a number of occasions to provide that perspective. And in fact, the bill that was just, or the statute that was just mentioned, I brought that up a number of times. And it's As this is written, it's clear that these are not, this isn't the work that Dr. Firpo is doing. It's not with fetuses. They're not doing something like that. But the original bill did say a conceptus. I mean, these are conceptuses. There's no question about that. The frozen embryos, that's what they are. And so the response from the university to me has been, our attorneys have looked at it. It doesn't really apply. And, you know, also with regard to the oversight that has been claimed by members of the, lobbying for industry and whatnot, 2 years ago I was asked to be part of the Stem Cell Advisory Committee for the Stem Cell Institute to provide maybe an alternative viewpoint. In that 2 years, of course, there's been a lot of transition in the Stem Cell Institute, but in that 2 years, that committee has not met. And earlier today, I called Professor Kahn, who is the chair of that committee, and asked him if they're going to meet, and he said they'll be meeting soon. So I think, it may say in bills that there is oversight, but you just have to ask questions, I think, if there has not been as much oversight as you might hope.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Calvin, what is cloning?
Well, cloning, if you want to use the best example of Dolly the sheep, is taking the genetic material from a living animal or human, putting it into a cell which will allow it to grow so that the product of that would be an identical twin, basically, shifted in time. And that's what Dolly the sheep was a cell taken from one of the somatic cells of, actually I think from the udder of one of the sheep, and put into a cell and then grown as an embryo. So, I know that cloning has all kinds of all kinds of things attached to it, but my contention that somatic cell nuclear transfer, and I even understand the background on why this might be a good thing, because we can take cells from our own bodies, grow them for a while, and develop certain types of cell lines that we could then use to heal our diseases, potentially. But that still involves doing something that basically makes an early embryo. And that's the concern that many of us have. Now, I think there may be possible things down the road that our nuclear material can be utilized in a way that does not make it an embryo first. And I think that has potential. And I'm open and willing to look at all aspects of that. But that would be my definition of cloning. And I would certainly also defer to Dr. Firpo. This is her area of expertise. I just deliver babies all night long.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Calvin, do you believe that this bill is a cloning bill?
What I believe is that the description of somatic cell nuclear transfer is, I believe, actual cloning. It's an early stage of cloning. It would, an analogy would be, it's crossing into drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Preserve. It's crossing into an area where we say, well, we need the oil. Some people say no, but we don't want to mess up that area. There are good arguments. All of us have people in our families who have illnesses and have difficulties that we would like to cure, but there are certain points at which we would say, no, we shouldn't cross into that. So it's a technology that many of us who are concerned about cloning have as a worry.
Thank you.
Okay. Professor Firpo, are you asking Representative Murphy?
If Dr. Firpo has a different answer, I would hearing that.
You want the definition of cloning, Mr. Chair?
Yes, to that question.
The definition of cloning a human being. Cloning is used in science in many ways, but it means making a copy. And we clone DNA, we make a copy of the DNA. We call it cDNA after that. But when you talk about cloning a human being, you talk about making an exact duplicate genetically of that person. It does not require removing material from any other organism. In fact, it happens reasonably often by identical twins where the embryo splits into two. So you can actually clone a person by taking an embryo and making it into two embryos. This has been actually accomplished in non-human primates. But essentially, that's what is done. One way of accomplishing cloning a human being would be to do somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is what you were referring to there. But there actually are other ways of accomplishing that goal, too.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Purple, do you believe that House File 34 leads to cloning?
I apologize for not being a legal expert, but I have a PhD in cell biology and genetics. I can give you my opinion. There's a difference between nuclear transfer and human cloning. Nuclear transfer is a technique of removing the nucleus from one cell and placing it into another cell. You can do this to use this to create another human being, although it has not actually occurred yet in humans. It most likely will happen. But you can also use it to replace the nuclei of non-oocyte cells and work with transferring nuclei from somatic cell to metasomatic cell. Or you can actually transfer nucleus from a somatic cell into an oocyte, create something similar to an embryo, and grow a cell line. This is what people refer to sometimes as therapeutic cloning, where you actually make a cell line that's genetically identical to the patient so that you can generate cells for transfer. This has actually been accomplished in mice. So, but hopefully that covers all of it. But nuclear transfer does not, allowing nuclear transfer research does not mean that we are going to be cloning people. That would require making an embryo, implanting it in a uterus, and creating a pregnancy. And this is not the definition of nuclear transfer. It's a separate procedure.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
Let's follow up with Ms. Verpo. If you took that cell that was created for a therapeutic clone and implanted it in the uterus, what would happen to it?
It would form a tumor. A cell, an embryonic stem cell implanted in the uterus.
I'm talking about the cell that you have taken the somatic cell material and implanted it. So you've created the clone, and if you took that and implanted it into a uterus, what would happen to that?
If you did nuclear transfer with a nucleus and put it into an oocyte and implanted it in the uterus, it might develop into a pregnancy.
Thank you.
Mr. Wojda? And Mr. Wojda and Mr. Ellison, if it is, I've given the other side, this side, quite a bit more time, so would you limit your testimony to 3 minutes?
I think I've got just about that much time. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to address you. My name is Paul Wojda. I teach at the University of St. Thomas. Remember the theology department there. I'm also the director of the master's program in Catholic studies. I am also a bioethicist. A few years ago, the Science Museum of Minnesota asked me if I would be willing to provide some videotaped commentary for an exhibit on human embryonic stem cells that the museum was putting together. It was during the height of the stem cell controversies in the summer of 2001, just prior to President Bush's primetime address to the nation on this issue. And I had come to the museum's attention because I was then chairman of Archbishop Harry Flynn's Biomedical Ethics Commission and had been interviewed by a number of local media outlets about the Catholic Church's opposition to destructive human embryonic stem cell research. The curator of the exhibit was intent on presenting all sides of the debate and was rather happy to have found me because, as she explained, she was having trouble finding any diversity of opinion on this topic among local experts, by which term I understood her to mean bioethicists. A considerable complaint, given that there is no dearth of such creatures in this neck of the North Woods. Could I really be the lone bioethical voice in opposition to human embryonic stem cell research hereabouts? Of course, I wasn't then, nor am I today, the only expert to object to the sort of research practices that the bill before you would permit, which includes not only the deliberate destruction of nascent human life, but also the deliberate creation with a view to destruction of nascent human life. That is what the bill refers to as somatic cell nuclear transfer, but which in other contexts has been called therapeutic cloning. A half decade of intense debate, much of it prompted by President Bush's Council on Bioethics, has made at least this much clear. There are significant arguments against these destructive research practices, arguments put forward by serious and highly qualified individuals. These arguments deserve a hearing. Indeed, in the brief time allotted me today, I want to present the rough outlines of at least one of them. To begin with, opponents of destructive embryonic stem cell research and human cloning labor against a persistent distortion of this debate in the mass media, namely that this conflict is but the latest installment in a modern warfare between science and religion, with the forces of enlightened reason, progress, and freedom on one side versus irrational, backward-looking, and dogmatic believers on the other. That this debate is not between science and religion, but about the sort of science and medicine we want, is evident to anyone who takes the time to consider the arguments. However, since I've raised the issue of religion, and since I speak here as a Catholic theologian, let me attempt to clear up another common misperception about the relation of faith and ethics in public policy debates. For it is also common for religious believers, such as myself, to be shut out of serious public debate simply by dint of being religious. From the Catholic perspective, at least, the most profound moral truths, such as that every human being, and especially the most vulnerable among us, has an inviolable claim to our respect and protection from harm, are the common patrimony of all humankind. Though the community of believers nurtures these truths and imparts them to its members through particular stories, rituals, and doctrines, it can no more claim ownership of them than Americans can claim to have patented the idea of political liberty. In short, faith may illumine these moral truths, but it does not create them. They are already there. For Catholics and many other people of faith, therefore, what is at stake in this debate over destructive embryonic stem cell research is not whether our faith will be written into law, but whether in our scientific and medical practices we are to be guided any more by a particular vision of the human person, a vision that has, until fairly recently, shaped and been sustained by those very practices themselves. What is that vision? While it has been expressed in many different ways, its central feature is the fundamental uniqueness or irreplaceability of every single member of the human species. Religious people often speak here in terms of creation in the image and likeness of God. It is this vision that informs the founding documents of this country. It is in defense of this vision that we fought a horribly destructive civil war. It is this vision that for over 70 years of the century just passed serves as the crucial distinction between our form of civil association and those in which utopian visions of a perfect society not only permitted but demanded state-sanctioned slavery and genocide. Indeed, I do not think it is going too far to say that the basic moral measure we commonly apply to preceding generations is the degree to which they extended the franchise called the human family rather than restricted it. Would that we apply the same measure to our generation. Our children and grandchildren may one day ask for an accounting. The proper function of power, wrote the eminent political philosopher Hannah Arendt, is to protect. As one of the most perceptive observers and critics of totalitarian political movements of the 20th century, who experienced these movements firsthand, she knew whereof she spoke. We are today faced with a new and, in many ways, far more formidable power, the power of genetic science and medicine, ever more tightly bound to the engines of economic globalization. The bill before us gives lip service to the necessity of tethering this power to some process of moral scrutiny, but it is no more than lip service, for its central provision would permit the deliberate destruction of our most vulnerable neighbors, and even worse, would demand that destruction. Should this bill become law, we can reasonably ask whether we have, at least in Minnesota, anything resembling science and medicine, at least in the form we once recognized and honored. That is to say, a science and medicine in the service of the whole human family. Thank you.
Questions of Professor Voida. Thank you, Professor. And finally, Mr. Ellison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I gave you a rather lengthy tome, and I have bullet points that I'll fly through at a much more rapid pace, and you can look at the footnotes. As I'm sure you'll probably be looking at this issue again in the future. My name is Kirk C. Allison, PhD and MS. I am the director of the Program in Human Rights and Health of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, formerly Human Rights and Medicine. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you. Certainly, stem cell research stakes are very high for all involved. We've heard this from a patient point of view, from a physician point of view, from a scientist point of view, from an economic point of view. And it's also high from what the United Nations Declaration on Human Cloning of 2005 terms human dignity. It's crucial that the university have research that is ethical and prudent and has a long view of the ethical costs and possible benefits in that order. Now, I want to point out for your benefit and for the benefit of perhaps one of your committee members that on Monday, February 26th, from 8:30 to 5 p.m. at the University of Minnesota is a conference called Creating Stem Cells by Research Cloning, Scientific, Ethical, Legal, and Policy Challenges. I invite somebody from the committee to attend. It states, we will lead a national audience in exploring the application of somatic cell nuclear transfer, also known as research cloning. This is co-sponsored by the Stem Cell Institute. And in fact, on the afternoon, there's a breakout session, a primer on the science of research cloning and stem cells, which is directed by Professor Mary Fierpo, Ph.D. So if there's any confusion of whether we are talking about a form of cloning, I think attending that session should take care of that. This conference is pertinent because stem cell derivation by SCNT is research cloning, and the bill allows any source of the embryos or of stem cells without gestational limits. It also disregards the 2005 United Nations Declaration on Human Cloning, which calls on member states, quote, to adopt all measures necessary to prohibit all forms of human cloning inasmuch as they are incompatible with human dignity and the protection of human life. The United States is a signatory of that declaration, and it's clear in the discussions of the defense and the assent that research cloning is included under that description. There are binding statutes in Canada and Norway, not in Great Britain or Korea. House File 34, unfortunately, is model legislation, which inherits the good, the bad, and the ugly of all model legislation that gets circulated around the 50 states. One of its deficits is that it forecloses any ethical consideration categorically limiting obtaining stem cells from any source, as we have heard from somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is a form of cloning in this case, lab-generated IVF embryos, fetal gamete cells that are matured, IVF clinic embryos, and only after that it says that full consideration of ethical and medical implications shall be given. So you allow everything, and then you say, we'll have the ethical discussion after having allowed that. Now, what about oversight? There's a formal error in the bill, and in all of the bills that have this across the state. It states that this research shall be reviewed by an approved institutional review board, an IRB, and here is the problem. The mandate and competency of an IRB falls under 45 Code of Federal Regulations 46, titled Human Subject Protection, and does not apply to much of embryonic and other stem cell research. And as Professor Fierpo has noted, they receive anonymized eggs, and that is the point. Informed consent, IVF, that has IRB review at some point in the past or at in the point of transfer. However, once it's anonymized, it does not extend to anonymized embryos, gametes, embryos from these or stem cell lines per se. So what criteria will the approved IRB apply in such cases when it falls out of their legal description mandate and the instrumentarium of their decisions about the protection of human subjects? An advisory committee is a poor fallback because there's no veto to stop inappropriate research. Advice is advice. The guidelines for human embryonic stem cell research, which was put together by the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine as an advisory document, indicates that perhaps stem cell oversight research committees with binding authority. That would actually be an improvement, but ironically, an IRB generally has a broad range of people sitting on it from a lot of disciplines, and there would probably be fewer conflicts of interest, although it's outside their mandate, so that's a problem. Limits. There are no time limits for gestation before deriving stem cells, tissue, or sacrificing a conceptus. There's not even the 14-day gestational limit of forming the embryonic neural streak that's found in congressional proposals mentioned in the guidelines or even present in Chinese regulations. And I don't usually praise the ethics of the Chinese government if, for those who know some of my other activities. Certainly, we have mentioned Minnesota Statute 145.421, which would put some limits on it at some point. This is what I call the N plus one ethical problem of basic biological research. The question is, at what point in the continuous cascade of biological development will stem cell transitions become uninteresting? How far will the generation in the cascade process be brought on? Will it be at pluripotent stem cells? Will it be at totipotent at the beginning where it can become another embryo, or it can become another full organism? Pluripotent, it can become all tissue types. Multipotent, it can become a number of types. Progenitor stem cells, one type. Or will it be at the point where there will be geometric formation of organs when people are talking about growing a new organ? What will be the matrix of that? This bill provides no breaks anywhere along the way for that. And there's a specter that I see. Some members of the university's Central Ethics Advisory Board have indicated in specific circumstances were it legal, gestation of pregnancies with the intent to abort to obtain stem cells for therapeutic purposes would be ethical, if disturbing, and probably to be discouraged. The article is referenced. This does not particularly inspire confidence as to what limits would apply. Now, I would like to say a few words that hopefully everybody can agree with, no matter what you think on this issue, so that this can be generally applicable further down the road in public discussions of science. It's the problem of information in the public representation of science. Now, in policy context, concerning the oversight of scientists, non-scientists, including most legislatures and the public, are at a distinct disadvantage because there's a great knowledge inequality. But with the knowledge inequality, there's also a certain power differential. Even the non-special scientists are at an advantage, and so therefore it's incumbent upon specialists to be candid about the functional facts and uncertainties and not provide evidence claiming to be evidence. That is one of the most destructive things to science, as we've seen in, for example, the Korean stem cell debacle and in other contexts. Now, certainly maximalist claims at the beginning of a new discipline are very good for obtaining funding. But their falsification horizons of when those claims are false are far enough off that one doesn't have to provide the evidence up front. That is a problem. But we've seen this again before in fetal tissue and early gene therapy. For example, when fetal tissue was transplanted into Parkinson's patients, they had worse dyskinesia, and the trial was stopped. But all things were promised by this as being very promising, and one shouldn't let ethics get in the way of desperate patients. Scientists can translate, but some are not willing to. For example, Ronald D.J. McKay, who's a stem cell researcher at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, says, to start with, people need a fairy tale. Maybe that's unfair, but they need a story that's relatively simple to understand. But I think policy formers, the citizens, and patients above all need facts, candid acknowledgement of uncertainty, independent access to information. And I think everybody can learn to use PubMed if you can learn to Google, which is the medical database, and you can look at the abstracts, and then you don't have to go through the filter. Journalists are lax in standards and sources and repeat misinformed claims, occasionally greeting corrections with disinterest or hostility. And I have an example. February 12th...
We're going to be out of here in 2 minutes, and we've got a question here.
So. All right, please.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, first of all, I'd like to ask if we have a roll call vote on the bill if we're going to vote it out of here today.
I don't believe we're going to vote out of here today because I believe there's some amendments. I don't know how we're going to have a discussion of those amendments in 2 minutes, and I've been very lenient with the witnesses that I told to take 5 minutes, and I've given the opposition quite a bit more time, so I've tried to be fair and... We've run out of time. Representative Kahn will have to continue this bill at the beginning of Tuesday's meeting, where we'll take your amendments. Representative Eastman, your question?
I'll leave my question. I just wanted to get on the list. I was going to ask a question, actually, of a different witness, so that's fine.
If there's no question for me, you can feel free to ask another witness. And you can, in between now and the next session, you can look through my written remarks and the footnotes.
Thank you.
And that's sufficient. Thank you. I appreciate your time. A couple of minutes.
If you have a question.
Okay. Well, I guess I was just reading some information as this testifier was speaking, and I don't know if Representative Kahn would be the one to ask this question or not, there was a comment earlier, I think, Dr. Furpo, you said something about treatment of diabetes. And I'm just trying to get a a picture in my mind of what it would mean if we would find a picture or find some kind of a cure for diabetes in an embryonic stem cell line. What I'm reading here, it says that there's about 17 million people in the United States with diabetes. Just from a practical standpoint, if there was a cure inside of the stem cell research community here in embryonic stem cells, how could we address that big of a problem? How could we get enough stem cells, eggs? What would be the magnitude of that problem to try to just market that cure?
Okay, so I'm going to try and condense all my research down to like 30 seconds. So there are transplantation therapies for type 1 diabetes. This is an islet transplant. They're not durable. They last for maybe a year, maybe two. If we could, and the limitation, of course, is the number of donor pancreas that people donate their bodies to science, and they're appropriately available. The having unlimited, and with embryonic stem cells, theoretically unlimited number of cells, would mean that we were only limited in terms of the way that we could grow the cells and the sort of cost of the therapy. But it would be, we have a transplantation, this is one of the reasons I came here, was we have this transplantation model to sort of provide cells for this transplantation. We could potentially provide therapy for all people with type 1 diabetes and possibly also type 2. So, yes, it could have a huge impact.
Just one follow-up. So then help me understand how stem cells work. I was under the understanding that we had to have eggs to create the nuclear, whatever you call that, to create the stem cells. So help me understand how that works. Do we need...
I think there was a mistake actually in the previous testimony. We do not actually receive eggs from donors. We receive embryos from donors. And it does not, and creating a cure for diabetes using embryonic stem cells does not require somatic cell nuclear transfer. We can make embryonic stem cells and provide cells for transplantation without doing nuclear transfer. The advantage or the reason that behind using nuclear transfer for diabetes research is twofold. One, we don't have a genetic test for people who are going to have diabetes where we could actually create embryonic stem cell lines from cells from people who have diabetes and create a model in the lab that we could use to test therapies. And two, to get around the problem of immune rejection, which is a problem both with current embryonic stem cells and also with the islet transplants we have now.
One final.
Quickly.
I'm still trying to understand how do you create an unlimited number of stem cells.
This is the real value. One of the real unique properties of embryonic stem cells is we can propagate them in the lab without changing them to maintain their stem cell and all their potential in theoretically unlimited. The amount of reagents we have is really the limitation. And then at some point differentiate them, allow them to change into insulin-producing cells in the lab. And there's no real limit on the amount of cells we could produce in the lab.
From one egg?
From one embryo.
From one embryo, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Hartman moves the minutes of yesterday's meeting. Representative Hartman, are there any additions or corrections?
There's one correction, Mr. Chair. In the third to the last line, House File 797 should be changed to House File 398.
Representative Hartman, you're sharp. You put that in there just to see if you catch it. Okay, members, you've heard the motion to move the minutes from yesterday as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members and Representative Kahn and any other witnesses that want to be here, we will start then immediately at 12:30 with Representative Severson's, I believe, amendment.
I don't have mine, but
meeting adjourned.